This is the Porno Cultures Podcast, the show where we think about pornography rather than just react to it. Hello. Welcome to the Porno Cultures Podcast. In this episode, I'm speaking with Professor David Church, who teaches in the Department of Comparative Cultural Studies at Northern Arizona University. He received his PhD in Communication and Culture at the University of Indiana. He's the author of Grindhouse Nostalgia, Memory, Home Video, and the Exploration of Film Fandom, published by Edinburgh University Press in 2015, and he edited the collection entitled Playing with Memories, Essays on Guy Maddin, published by the University of Manitoba Press in 2009. His newest book, and the one that we're going to be talking about today, is Disposable Passions, Vintage Pornography and the Material Legacies of Adult Cinema, published by Bloomsbury Academic in 2016. What's fascinating about this book is the way in which he situates these porn texts from the early 1900s to the beginning of the Golden Age, starting in the 1960s, within our contemporary contexts. He writes about how we consume and understand these vintage texts via the internet and through contemporary restoration and distribution companies. This is one of the most unique approaches to porn studies that I've ever encountered, and is surely a blueprint for how film history will have to evolve into the future. In this interview, we talk about whether or not these vintage texts can still be considered porn if we think about them as historical objects rather than objects of erotic stimulation, and we also consider the connection between cinephilia and necrophilia. And we talk about why he thinks affect theory is the best theoretical approach towards analyzing these vintage porn texts. I hope that David's work might help you think and look at these older texts in some new ways. I really think he gets into some very interesting points that we don't often think about because we don't always think about how history needs to be contextualized within our contemporary age. So here is my interview with Professor David Church. So we're here at the Hard Rock Hotel. It's actually quite nice, beautiful hotel here, much nicer than the restaurants. We're here with David Church to talk about his book, Disposable Passions, Vintage Pornography and the Material Legacies of Adult Cinema, published by Bloomsbury Press and released in 2016. So David, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for doing this.
Your book is really unique in many ways. Of course, its main task is to analyze how vintage pornography, and by vintage, I mean, you know, stag movies made from cinema's inceptions in the late 1800s until the emergence of pornography in the Golden Age. You focus on how these movies are marketed, repurposed, fetishized in our contemporary digital age, which is a very different approach to these texts than what we usually see. But something that strikes me as terribly essential if we're going to conceive of the multitude of ways in which a variety of older texts are going to be recontextualized within new media platforms. You know, you do a great job of reconceiving this, so kudos for doing this essential work. It's really quite interesting. Perhaps the most interesting aspect of the book is the way you begin it with the provocative quote from Tim Lucas's 1994 novel, Throat Sprockets, which that title alone makes me want to read it, where he writes, quote, "I should explain that adult movies, X movies, triple X, whatever you want to call them, have never particularly aroused me. On the contrary, I found myself drawn to them because of the disenchantment with mainstream films." And then you go on to explain that your own thoughts about pornography mirror Lucas's. Can you talk about your personal relationship to pornography in more detail and explain how someone who isn't particularly aroused by it can go about writing about it in such great detail?
Well, at some point in the introduction, I do try to say I'm maybe not quite as disenchanted by pornography as Lucas's narrator, but I've always been sort of attracted to marginal types of films, whether they're experimental films or exploitation films, or in this case, pornographic genre, because they're doing something different. You know, they're exciting me in different ways than you get in a typical form of cinema. As far as my own personal relationship to pornography goes, I saw very little of it growing up. So I guess kudos to my parents for keeping me safe from all of the supposed dangers involved there.
Look at how well you turned out.
Yeah, of course. So by the time I got to college, though, I saw a stag film for the first time. And that sort of struck my interest in what became this project eventually. I was really interested by how, almost surreal, looking at actual sex from this particular time period, the 20s or 30s, how strange that was because of how much it clashes with what we typically associate with our sort of, cultural reservoir of moving images from that time period, which is, of course, typically either newsreels or Hollywood films or things like that. So that sort of turned into the genesis for this project, and I started to think more about, well, what does it mean to eroticize the past? This is a case where we have a particular genre that has been misremembered or simply written out of histories for so long, and the ways that you see the entire history of this genre consumed today, it's sort of funneled into this particular sort of fetish category called vintage. And you can see that certainly to some extent with other types of cinema, classic Hollywood, for example. But I think there's something about vintage as a label which suggests something about fetishizing historicity itself. So I was sort of interested to approach this project by going somewhat beyond, hopefully, a strictly kind of historical empirical approach, just dealing with archival materials, which can, of course, be somewhat dry in and of itself. And I wanted to somehow combine that archival approach, though, with a little more focus on affect and try to say, okay, what are the affective resonances that come out of encountering these ephemeral or aged films?
And you said that your parents kept you away from pornography as long as they could. Do you remember the first time that you saw it? What was the experience like?
I'm trying to remember when I first saw, say, a hardcore image. And strangely enough, I have much more potent memories of, say, nude scenes in Hollywood movies that I would see at, friends' sleepover parties and things like that. A couple of particular scenes from, slasher movies from the 80s and things like that. But when it comes to what we might consider sort of proper pornography, at least by today's standards, it probably wasn't until the early years of the internet, or at least in the mid-90s when that was starting to get going. I was one of those folks coming of age at the same time that the internet itself was sort of coming of age. And so part of that sort of, I guess, technological development and personal development sort of went in tandem for a bit there. And finally, though, by the time I got to college and had a little more freedom in a lot of respects, I could start to explore this genre more broadly. But it wasn't until relatively recently that I really started to become interested in the more historically distant forms.
You mentioned that you got struck by this project when you were in graduate school, but your first book is actually about more grindhouse underground cinema. So your dissertation was more on what?
The dissertation was about nostalgia for specific exhibition spaces, urban grindhouses and also rural drive-in theaters. And I was fascinated by the ways that cultural memories of those types of exhibition spaces have become more important in recent years as, I think, a reaction against some of the sheer availability of these sorts of films and some of the ways that the films themselves are being restored and put out in much more sort of pristine condition. So the idea of something like grindhouse quality artifacting is something that's become much more central these days as a way of sort of turning back toward the past and looking to some sorts of kind of haptic experiences of viewing that potentially get lost when it's easy to find the most obscure exploitation film today, put out in a very nice DVD or Blu-ray repackaging.
Yeah, I mean, look at even Quentin Tarantino's Grindhouse, how that's so pristine, and even, with the fake line, the mm-hmm. fake deterioration, so that whole movie is a lot of what you're talking about. We're in Chicago. We were at the SMS Film Conference. I presented a paper about the porn theater in Montreal, Cinema L'Amour, and it struck me that a lot of the questions after the thing were about this concept of nostalgia. And with distance, there's a kind of a nostalgia for the things that we were pushing aside for so many years. Not so long ago, I took a picture when I was in Times Square. There's always a lot of construction going around in New York, and they usually just boarded up walls. This time they put image of what Times Square used to look like in the 1970s. So you have this image of a porn theater from the 1970s there in Times Square right next to where Cirque du Soleil is putting on their Broadway production. Literally, I mean, it took 30, 40 years for them to finally push all these businesses out. Now we're kind of like saying, oh, isn't this cool? Wasn't it like cool back then? So it strikes me, porn theaters are not antithetical to capitalism. I mean, they make money. Capitalism has nothing against pornography. It's only the quote-unquote, public morality that people want to project onto it. So there is some kind of thing where capitalism gives us an idea that we can embrace these kind of subversive cultures, obviously, because it's always repackaging them and reissuing them. Then there's
the idea of hegemony, which hegemony takes everything into account and then spits it back out into a very digestible form. And I thought to myself, if a porn theater opened up in Williamsburg like 2 or 3 years from now, I don't think anyone would be surprised. So it strikes me that there needs to be at least some thinking about this return of the repressed through like the return of the nostalgia. Like, there seems to be something about that, like nostalgia reawakening, reemerging, and becoming more palatable. Can something like that even transcend, you know, the arguments about morality eventually?
Right. Well, the separation of nostalgia from capitalism is always very difficult. As far as the separation of nostalgia from morality, that strikes me as something a little bit separate. You know, nostalgia, we tend to write it off as simply being about shoring up morality, you know, make America great again sort of rhetoric about, you know, nostalgia for the past as a better time. But then, of course, there are people like, you know, Samuel Delaney and all sorts of folks writing about areas like Times Square. And, you know, although he was writing certainly at the moment during the Giuliani administration when all of that change was going on, something about turning back to the past and using nostalgia for somewhat more progressive purposes and what we might consider amoral purposes is maybe useful. It's striking when you say that, you know, if a porn theater would open in Williamsburg, you know, all sorts of hipsters
maybe
would be...
Maybe it's just my fantasy.
No, I mean, there are certainly repertory theaters in those parts of New York that have, just in the last few years, started to screen 35 prints and Blu-ray of vintage porn films.
Really? In Brooklyn?
Well, I'm not sure in Brooklyn itself. I'm trying to think. There's one particular theater that has done some of that, but I can't remember the name right off the top of my head.
It's in New York?
I believe so, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. That I didn't know about.
And certainly at Anthology Film Archives, a couple years ago, Casey Scott programmed In the Flesh series. That was a quarterly series that went on for about a year and a half or so, where he had basically weekends set aside for screening vintage pornographic films, mostly from the 70s and early 80s, on 35, and inviting various filmmakers, performers, folks involved in the production to be there and be interviewed. So there was something about the physicality of an event like that. And something that strikes me as interesting is that there are these slow efforts to maybe bring pornography back into reconsideration as works of a legitimate genre. Right now, we're far enough down the road from the sex wars of the 80s and so on, and all the vitriolic anti-porn rhetoric of that time, that people are, I think, just over the last few years starting to reappraise these films in ways that they haven't before. And part of that is certainly the accessibility of really nicely restored and respectfully restored versions of the films themselves put out by Vinegar Syndrome, DistroPix, companies like that, which is something that I talk about a bit in the book. But I think there's something ironic about the fact that these companies are starting to re-embrace these movies at a time when physicality itself within the media landscape is slowly going away. You know, the move toward immaterial or streaming-only formats and whatnot.
Theater owners, since no one goes to the theater anymore, only like 35% of the American population actually go into a theater once during the course of a year, they're doing so many different things to bring people back. So what better way? I mean, pornography brings so many people together. So that's really interesting that that's happening.
Yeah.
In lieu of going into a lengthy textual analysis of the films covered in your book, you focus on the ways in which communities, whether they be composed of individuals or revolve around business interests, enact practices around, quote, the pleasures of collectability, connoisseurship, and historical knowledge that are more closely aligned with the dynamics of exploitation film fandom than fandom of most contemporary hardcore pornography. You always bring us back to exploitation, fandom, cinephilia, and pornography, how they're linked. In many ways, you make clear that this book is a type of sequel to your first book, Grindhouse Nostalgia, which details the practices of fan cultures around underground cinema. What was the driving force behind you making such a distinction? And what are the most important differences that we as porn scholars should keep in mind when we're conceiving of communities around these texts?
Well, the issues about what constitutes a fan community around pornography is something that's, I think, still somewhat fraught. There's still this idea that porn fandom, rather than other types of fandom that have been reappraised by the field of fan studies, for example, porn fandom is still seen as somehow dirty, illicit. There's always the specter of the porn addict lurking in the background, all those sorts of things. And what I wanted to do in part with this book is to say, well, fans, scholars, historians, whether professional or amateur, archivists, home video distributors, these are all archive-dependent figures. So what does it mean for all of them to sort of go back to the archive or make their own archives to somehow appreciate these films as works of a legitimate genre and not just as more sort of disposable streaming clips that you might see on a tube site? Now, of course, you can still watch a lot of these same vintage films on, you know, X-Hamster or X-Tube or whatever, pick your large tube site. But I think there's something about the more respectful treatment of these films and the way that these films are starting to be seen more and more as not just something to masturbate to or not just something to sort of take up with ironic humor in the sort of paracinema type way, but to actually see them as having more historical value to them and also the value of the people who work in them as well. I think there's something about reappraising these films that also can't be separated from a reappraisal of the value of sex work. And so there's sort of an ethical imperative to take these films seriously.
That this is a document of sex work.
Yeah, and it's a document, obviously, of sex work of a particular time period, so it, of course, reflects the sexual attitudes of that time period, which may or may not be that acceptable to us today. But nevertheless, I think we need to keep a well-preserved and accessible archive of these films nonetheless.
But what about the physical dimension? There must have been a time when people were masturbating to these things, and of course now, today, it seems to many people almost unimaginable to be able to masturbate to these vintage porns. So what about that difference? The difference between, yes, we have the grindhouse experience, which is its own particular thing, more conventional, you know, passive experience, versus an experience that, at least at that time, was pretty engaged, or at least engaged viewing through masturbating.
Right. Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that the grindhouses were that much of a passive experience, since, well, they may have been for some people coming in to, you know, get out of the cold or something like that and sleep for a couple hours. A lot of people were going in there to cruise. So clearly for those people, it was a very, very active experience. And some of the few surviving moving image records that we have from that time period of some of that activity actually come to us through vintage porn movies like A Night at the Adonis or The Back Row, or, you know, these films that are actually doing a good job of documenting what was going on in porn theaters at that time, particularly for gay men. But masturbation and autoerotic activities are somehow divorced from these films. I don't necessarily see that being entirely true. I mean, when I've interviewed a number of the folks who are putting out these films in, you know, remastered versions, folks like Joe Rubin or Stephen Morowitz, they do tend to admit that, yes, people are probably still buying these movies for the sex scenes, but they hope that people will be appreciating them for broader reasons as well. So, for instance, if you look at the chapterization of a Vinegar Syndrome DVD, most sort of mediocre DVD versions that haven't been restored and have been put out by some of these classic studios like VCA, VCX, Caballero, all these companies that are still sort of around from the old days, they tend to chapterize their DVDs according to sex scene. So you can jump to the particular scene. Of course, fragmenting the film or allowing the film to be fragmented if you want to use it for those sort of utilitarian purposes. But Vinegar Syndrome is doing something different in terms of chapterizing their films according to print reel. So you can't as easily just simply jump around to the sex scene. And it, of course, places a lot more emphasis upon the materiality of the surviving print elements, not just even divided up by narrative event the way that most conventional DVDs are. So there's something about building different modes of reception into the way that these films are being put back out there. Although it certainly, again, isn't necessarily removing the more, you know, erotic purposes that people might still achieve from them.
It reminds me of the famous allegory, if a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it, does it make a sound? If no one is there to masturbating or being aroused by these texts, do they continue to be pornography? Does there need to be another qualification for them?
That's, I think, where some of the issues of historicity sort of come in here. You know, if something becomes old enough and dated enough that people are starting to laugh at it, or simply seeing it as kind of an ironic time capsule, rather than simply, you know, having it sort of cut through that and affect them on a more visceral level, there's something going on there. So I was really just kind of fascinated by this idea of what does it mean to consider these films pornography today versus pornography in the past? Since, after all, a lot of these films, say 60s exploitation films, for example, we might not consider to be pornographic today because they aren't crossing over into hardcore territory. They may just seem fairly innocuous in some ways.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've shown pornography in my classes, and we've watched Deep Throat. Mm-hmm. You know, the music itself just makes you want to laugh.
Right,
it's very,
right.
Very dramatic music.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's interesting to see, you know, how these texts evolve.
Yeah, and, you know, I have just been curious about the ways that pornography itself has gotten mapped onto this particular idea of what's available on the internet now. If you say pornography to a student today, their first thought is the sort of gonzo-style streaming clip.
Yeah.
They don't necessarily have a frame of reference that this was, at one point, a genre that aspired to be much more cinematic. So admittedly, the book project is sort of biased toward those moments in time when the films were themselves shot on film and aspired to at least halfway decent production values. I'm sure that's my own film studies bias coming out. And it's not to say that there aren't a lot of course, really fascinating things going on with digitally made pornographies born for the online market.
I hope there is. That's what my dissertation is about.
Yeah.
You write about, quote, vintage pornography's eroticization of pastness.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk more about your argument of connecting pornographic appreciation to cinephilia, which I know some cinephiles that might be upset about that, and how that eventually leads to, quote, cinelove's ambivalent connection to death. You have a sentence that talks about cinephilia and necrophilia being connected to each other. So maybe like the lineage of how you come up with porn appreciation and cinephilia, connect the two, and then cinephilia's connection to death.
That chapter, I was trying to sort of poke people in the eye a little bit as far as some of the more highfalutin rhetoric that we get around the sort of turn toward new cinephilia studies over the last few years. So much of that has gravitated toward things like slow cinema and toward these kind of fleeting moments that somebody might not necessarily appreciate in the film. So it tends to be a sort of anti-commercial gesture. On the
yes,
part of,
and then you even have Manola Dargis going as far as saying that since she's a film critic, she can see things in a movie that normal people can't.
And then we
wonder why film criticism is so irrelevant.
Of course, goes back to Christian Metz and Mulvey and all these folks who were starting to talk about their love of cinema, but always trying to distance themselves from cinephilia as a sort of masturbatory mode of viewing in its own right. And so what I wanted to try to do is to say, well, our cinephilia and pornographic arousal really that different? You know, if you go to Susanna Pessonin's argument about carnal resonance, is that really so different than, say, you know, what somebody watching a slow film might experience? Those moments that sort of, you know, they have that revelatory gesture in them that maybe strikes you and maybe doesn't strike anybody else the same way. And then there's, of course, the question of how do you translate that into writing? How do you capture that experience in some way?
So by making the connection, you're trying to say that making cinephilia a more effective experience and then connecting that to how we also view pornography.
Yeah, I think it's cinephilia through the body a bit more. A lowbrow form of cinephilia, if you like, as a way of hopefully trying to sort of knock cinephilia down off of its pedestal that it seems to have taken over the last few years. And by extension, then, the idea of connecting it to death and decay, the idea of arousal at the sight of these people who are doing something that is extremely vital, of course, you know, the vitality of sexuality itself, but these people are themselves probably dead by now. And the idea of then eroticizing the decay of not just the performers themselves and what they're doing, but also the decay of the material artifact itself. The fact that these films have been so poorly preserved over the years, and so part of cinephiliac appeal of these movies is the sort of haptic, textural quality of them. That idea that you can sort of reach out and caress the film, much the way the film is almost reaching out and caressing you in a bodily way.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, this is a body genre.
Of course.
It's about touching, it's about feeling, it's about the sense of the skin. So, yeah, that's an excellent point, actually. This idea of cinema or even television viewing being connected to death, my father always loves to point out when he sees a dog or something, he's like, that dog's dead. So that's always foremost on his mind. You bring up Linda Williams' famous analogy of situating erotic text as an itch and pornography as the scratch to that itch. The idea of erotica innocently tickling your fancy while hardcore pornography aggressively leaves nothing to the imagination. You suggest that this dynamic between the two texts mirrors our cultural appreciation and survival of the texts themselves, writing that, quote, the historical tension between the concealment and revelation has become sublimated into more tactile questions of cultural neglect versus cultural visibility, unquote. How do you negotiate this with the stark difference between the scarcity of vintage texts versus the abundance of texts available to us in the post-Golden Age era? Sure, the scarcity of the texts themselves makes them that much more sacred and precious, but just on a logistical level, there are more contemporary texts, and the porno aesthetic mimic today in movies and in television and in advertising resembles that of the modern pornography more than the vintage. So hasn't vintage pornography already lost a battle of cultural relevance? Don't people want that scratch over the itch?
That's a really interesting question. I think there is some sort of appeal of going back to a moment when there was certainly some amount of scarcity, some idea that there was an appeal involved in not being able to show everything at a particular point in time. And I think what I find so fascinating about vintage pornography and why it has renewed its sense of eroticism today is that the archive itself is basically doing a kind of striptease. So what Williams talks about in terms of the itch versus scratch or concealment versus revelation of sexual acts within the film becomes basically, you know, you can map it onto the archive itself in terms of some texts might vanish after they go out of circulation, then they come back, and then they go out of print again, and then there's constantly this coming and going of the texts themselves. And certainly different archives will value them differently based upon their ability to, you know, capitalize on that.
Is the kind of the porno aesthetic seen in movies, not hardcore, not the hardcore art films, but television advertising, is that the new vintage pornography? Is the Calvin Klein ad the new eroticism, erotica?
Well, certainly the arguments that get made about pornographication of mass culture, especially in the wake of porno chic, both in the 70s and then more recently with the rise of internet porn, there's something to be said there about, you know, those types of advertising or music videos or whatever it is drawing upon tropes from pornography, whether past or present. I think what's interesting is how, as we continue marching into the future, of course, what gets considered vintage is obviously going to continue to grow, going to constantly have this increasing backlog of materials that gradually get slotted into the niche for vintage. If you look at a website like Vintage Erotica Forums, for example, they have a cutoff date currently at 1993 is the most recent material that they'll consider worthy of uploading there. But of course, that's obviously going to march forward over the years. And so at a certain point, more and more of the things that we might consider to be porn-inspired today are going to gradually fall into that category. They're re-embracing maybe older forms of porn that, again, couldn't necessarily show everything.
We're going to have to start segmenting the decades. It's a separate type of the stack films, the pre, you know, the golden age. It's going to take a lot of classification by more historians as we go forward.
Yeah, and even a lot of the vintage porn websites out there already are already classified by decades. That's a pretty common way that they go about that. Most times that people ask me what I mean by vintage porn, they mean, oh, do you mean just shot on celluloid? And yeah, for the most part, that's what it has been. But clearly, as if we're moving into the 90s as something that's considered to be vintage now, that's going to include all sorts of things. Lots of shot on video porn, and I think, more interestingly, a wider variety of porn. So rather than the predominantly heterosexual and gay male pornographies that really sort of came of age in the 70s, for example, you're going to have a lot more shot on video feminist porn, queer porn, you know, just a broader range of things that were allowed to come into existence in the 80s because of the much lower costs of production and distribution. So there will be more sexual diversity reflected in what is considered vintage as time goes on.
The tough thing about this itch versus scratch stuff is that, yes, today it seems like an itch, but back then it must have been a monumental scratch. So how do we transfer this logic into its proper context?
I mean, it's always sort of an act of historical reconstruction. You know, how much can you truly put yourself into the shoes of somebody who was watching The Immoral Mr. T's in 1959? Something that by today's standards really looks awfully silly and about as innocuous as you could imagine. But clearly, what we might do is start to look at and draw comparisons between some of the more sort of moral panics that come up around, say, extreme pornographies in the UK or various rougher forms of pornographies that we see coming out these days and maybe say, well, are those things really that different than, say, some of the sexploitation roughies that came out back in the 60s, for example, which were often themselves quite misogynistic and really rather nasty, much more so than a lot of the hardcore films that came along later on in the 70s, in fact. So perhaps we can sort of read across time and try to draw some productive comparisons and contrasts by showing that a lot of these sorts of discourses haven't changed that much. But again, it would be sort of a fantasy act of time travel for us to really imagine what would it have been like to watch a stag film in a French brothel back in the 20s, for example.
One thing that's rarely covered, did you find any research about how these films were actually received at the time within the press?
Well, there certainly was some write-up of these films in terms of reviews in Variety, for example.
Oh, no, I'm even talking in the black and white early stag stage or the really vintage stuff.
Well, as far as those go, pre-60s films, there isn't that much material out there. There's a lot of newspaper advertising for stag films, stag parties, things like that, but not a whole lot really exists still in terms of...
People writing about their reactions.
The reactions.
I mean, we need to find some diaries, more diaries for private people.
Yeah, there are some interesting things, like certainly Tom Waugh writes about his encounters with stag films, but that was in the 60s, I believe. So a bit later on down the road, and probably involving films that were circulating for decades by that point, too. There's a documentary called American Stag that came out about 10 years ago that does interview some folks who were itinerant projectionists of these films. But yeah, a lot of that has simply sort of vanished to a great degree as far as audience responses. We simply have a lot of anecdotal mentions of people encountering stag films in all-male spaces and that being a sort of rite of passage and all that sort of thing. Partly because of the illegality of those films during that time period, there just hasn't been that much preserved.
Your theoretical framework is rooted in affect theory throughout the book, and you bring up the work of Susanna Passanen throughout. Why do you feel affect theory is the best way in which to talk about these texts?
Well, I wanted to do something a bit different than simply approaching them as archival objects. It's one thing to hide behind primary historical evidence and say just the facts approach to things. You know, here's what I found in the archive, here's how I'm telling the story of these things. That's a perfectly valid method, of course, but I wanted to also add affect as a way of not just personalizing the project, but also saying, how do these films continue to resonate with us today? You know, what are my own personal reactions to these films, and how do those square with the reactions that people may have had back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and so on? It seems to me that within the field of pornography studies, there's a bit of a methodological, I wouldn't say divide, that's maybe too strong of a word, but with the recent boom in historiographic work on adult film, that's one thing. It's very archive dependent, of course. And then off to the other side, there's a bit more of the queer informed work, which tends to draw much more on affect theory, I think. And so there's something there, perhaps, about having a queer identity or queer positionality allows you to explore the personal affective dimensions of these films a bit more. It's maybe a little more kosher, shall we say, within the field to put those things out there. So I was trying to sort of dip into both camps, as it were, as far as methodologically trying to talk about how the encounter with the archival object can still have a very affective presence upon us even today. And what then are the questions that we as historians might be able to make of how much they can still impact our bodies?
I think that's one thing that remains so remarkable about Linda Williams' book even today is how she really does both in the same book. That mm-hmm. she is able to do the history, and then she doesn't do affect, but she does Marxism, feminism, psychoanalytic theory. This is why this remains so eternal, so relevant, because it kind of bridges the divide that you're talking about, which I think is quite significant. I mean, I interviewed Peter Ilunis, I was on his panel, and yeah, I mean, the historical work is great, but there is a separation. You do see it's either going to be more historical or more theoretical. As far as the theoretical, the feminist aspect has been exhausted within most of porn studies, I think, for the most part. And so I think people are now looking for the next theoretical strand, you know, beyond mm-hmm. the psychoanalytic, beyond the feminism. It's a lot of people seem to be landing on affect. When did you come across affect theory, and how did you think that you wanted to use it in this book?
I came across it in grad school, like most things, and started to sort of think about, well, maybe it's holding a lot more weight right now within the field than classic feminist theory, for example, semiotic theory, structuralism, etc., etc. It seemed to me more interesting just because I've always had an interest in body genres of various types. And so how do you sort of think through your embodied reactions to things? It's always struck me as a much more interesting methodology than, say, film philosophy, which seems to be at the other theoretical extreme in terms of being so overly intellectualized that you many times lose sight of the film that's being talked about altogether, and it just simply becomes its own form of sort of intellectual masturbation.
That famous term.
Yeah. Which we can still get lots of mileage out of.
Well, yes, we're at an academic conference, so we see some of that here a lot.
Of course, yeah.
Have you thought about using theorists that don't address pornography directly, like Deleuze, Brian Massume? I'm using even Gilbert Simondon.
I've certainly read their work. I've had a big influence by Stephen Shaviro, for example, and you know, The Cinematic Body being one of those early works to draw upon Deleuze. and Guattari quite heavily in terms of framing things affectively. I haven't necessarily drawn on them that much for this particular project, but I think for the next project moving forward, I'll probably be drawing more from affect theory.
Affect's connection to ephemera. Mm. I think that's one of the most important things when we're talking about these vintage pieces, you know, getting little snippets here and there of what we can find. It almost seems foundational that if you're going to talk about ephemera, you'll have to talk about the remnants of the affect embodied within the type of ephemera. It kind of seems foundational.
There's been an increasing amount of work that's sort of bringing together material culture studies alongside affect theory and sort of thinking about, well, what does it mean to encounter objects that maybe were never intended for an archive, for example? Something where the trace of the material object itself somehow strikes you as having something to do with the trace of the love or the desire or the affection in some way that inspired somebody to keep that object around despite its very disposability. It seems like just in the past few years, there's been quite a bit of work in terms of trying to say, well, what does it mean to have an affective connection to something that's that trace?
What are your thoughts about affect theory's ability to get us beyond arguments around ideology? Ideology is, you know, kind of the structures in which we understand things. Brian Missomi writes that we no longer live under a dominant ideology, but instead live within a multitude of ideologies, which we traverse via affective forces. You don't particularly take Stack films to task for being sexist or racist. You were able to illustrate different aspects of them rather than just the ideological framework of, like, the new left. Does your approach speak to the futility of looking at text through the lens of identity politics? Well, is this the end of identity politics?
I'm not sure that I would say there's no more juice left in identity politics.
Yeah, it's a provocative question.
Yeah, I mean, certainly if you look at something like Black Lives Matters or something like that, identity politics is still extremely important to a lot of people. As far as, say, the way that affect theory has been taken up in conjunction with queer theory, there's where you're maybe starting to, you know, move away from conventional identitarian politics and move towards something that's trying to cross boundaries quite a lot more. But I think we still think of ourselves in terms of identities. So how can we ever entirely get away from identity politics on some level? As intersectional as we may think of ourselves today, it's hard to think outside the box of that, even on just a daily pragmatic level, I think.
Yes, and I had this kind of rear its ugly head when I showed some Stack films in my class. And it's also about projecting today's morality onto the vintage films. Mm-hmm. So we showed a series of 5 vintage films, and they involved men and women having sex. Nothing particularly violent. So there was a big discussion in the class about consent. Were these women consenting to what was happening to them? Should we be watching these movies through a different framework? You know, and there was a very long conversation about this idea of consent, because we had watched Deep Throat, uh-huh, you know, a few weeks before. And of course, we go into the fact that Linda Lovelace said that when you're watching the film, you're watching a rape, and that she had a gun to her head during some of the scenes. Mm-hmm. She had an abusive husband. But we also have the text in which she says, no, it was great. It was a good experience. She did gain a lot of fame from it. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting, and it was very disappointing that we had students projecting contemporary morality onto the past without contextualizing that morality is contextually dependent. And you mentioned it before, the vintage being a document of sex work. So how do you kind of advise viewers of vintage films to kind of think about these questions of, you know, morality, consent? You know, obviously there wasn't consent forms back then, right? I mean, it wasn't an established business. So if you were in front of my students, how do you address this question of imposing a contemporary morality onto these vintage texts?
On the one hand, you clearly have a lot of really canonical examples of vintage porn films, Deep Throat, like you mentioned, older things like the 1950s era Steg film Smart Aleck, starring Candy Barr, who claimed that she was drugged and forced into this film against her will by gangsters and was supposedly underage at that time too, all the way up through something more relatively recent like the Tracy Lords thing in the mid 80s, which of course was a huge scandal for the adult industry as a whole.
Brett Corrigan and the gay,
yep,
and he was 17.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's a tricky question about consent and what we should do as far as archival responsibilities to keeping these films around. Should we keep these films, even if they were procured or made under what would be, by contemporary standards, illegal conditions? It's a tricky question, and archives have had to deal with that in some ways, and some ways that they deal with it are better than others. I work pretty extensively with materials from the Kinsey Archive for this book, for example, and they have a policy of collecting pretty much anything that's donated to them. So they have a number of materials that would be considered illegal, you know, whether because of bestiality or underage performers or what have you. Some archives have tried to get around this by basically deaccessioning those items or...
What do you mean by that?
Taking them out of circulation, making sure that they're not available. Sometimes it's simply taking them out of their catalogs and finding aids so that people don't know that they're there. They're technically being kept there, but... who could possibly access them.
Now, in your experience, if they were to do such a thing, would an academic be able to see it or not?
Possibly. It depends. The Kinsey, for example, usually you can only gain access to things that are already cataloged by them and are available through the Indiana University Library's finding aids. What I've found, though, is that they do have some things cataloged in there that actually would be considered illegal. So, like, for example, Linda Lovelace's 8mm dog loops.
Yeah.
I believe there are several copies of that that are
cataloged. Just for those who don't know, there's a movie that claims that she had intercourse or had some sexual activities with a dog.
Yeah, that film does exist, and I believe it's there under several different titles. I never actually tried to access it. I think it would have been an interesting experiment to see what they would have said.
I can say the Museum of Sex in New York had an exhibition on Linda Lovelace, and they did show a clip of it, not of any dog, but
sure.
They do have a little... almost like a GIF image of, you know, her in a non-dog situation. So they acknowledged it and they kind of said that it was the case.
Films like that were made in Denmark, for example, for a number of years in the early 70s, before that was eventually stamped out. So there are still those types of materials floating around where, you know, consent and illegality become quite tricky.
And what do you tell your students?
To some degree, I try to bring up ideas about, like, sex trafficking today. You know, sex trafficking is still one of the main weapons that gets used against the porn industry. I always try to frame this idea about sex work in terms of, like, on the one hand, what are the options available to these performers in the first place? And second of all, is there coercion? Was there coercion? Personally, I have tried to refrain from exposing students to any films that have potentially involved coercion or things like that to try to get around some of those issues.
Neither was I.
But,
you know, they still bring it up because it's such a strong rhetoric.
Absolutely, yeah. It's maybe a strange parallel, but some of my other work has been in disability studies and ideas about, like, the freak show, for example. And there are all sorts of ways you could maybe draw parallels between freakery and pornography, since, after all, this is exotic displays of bodily difference.
That's your next book right there.
It certainly could be. But, you know, there have been debates, for example, in the field of disability studies about, you know, what did it mean for people to perform in a freak show? If you were born with a certain condition or acquired a certain condition which didn't leave you a lot of other opportunities for making money, this was one way that you could do that. The question is, you know, how much agency do you ascribe to that? And that's a tricky question. But I think for my purposes, it always comes back to sort of pragmatic questions. Should you simply tell a man or woman, well, you shouldn't perform in pornography because it's degrading or it'll come back to haunt you years later, or, you know, X, Y, or Z, these things that sort of separate legal consent from, say, informed consent, since, after all, you can sort of presume that if you make a pornographic film today, someone you know is going to see it. It's not going to remain a secret.
Even films that you make in secret will probably be seen in public as well, eventually.
Well, yeah, especially with all the hacking going on these days. My position as far as issues of consent and sex work and how all those things sort of filter down is, which is a worse option? To say, well, these women or men or whoever the performers are should have no agency, they should have no say over how they use their bodies, or is it a greater social good to allow them to economically maintain themselves?
I've always said the sex trafficking thing, I've always thought, is a rhetoric promoted by big business corporations, because there's far more worker trafficking throughout the world illegally to get people to work for slave labor, work as basically slave labor. So I think that the sex trafficking thing is a great distraction for us ever to talk about that, which is a far greater trafficking issue than sex trafficking. And two, as far as the consent, I always tell people, you know, if people who, you know, today who want to say, oh, Thomas Jefferson, he was an awful person, he had slaves, that's like judging us to, you know, from 100 years from now. If 100 years from now, if it's moral to, you know, instead of giving a homeless person a dollar, you invite them over to your house for a meal and you let them sleep at your house, 100 years from now would look at us and say, could you believe that people never invited homeless people into their house? I mean, the context of morality changes so radically over time. And Camille Paglia talks about this a lot, that we're under this delusion that we're always on an upward trajectory towards some kind of perfect union, of kind of perfect morality or perfect, and it's a joke. I mean, the course of human history is up and down, with savagery to evolution to the Renaissance. I mean, it's insane. So you have to be very, very careful to basically not impose a contemporary morality onto the past. It's just a fool's errand.
Yeah, and I think part of that is also, again, going back to that archival issue. You know, if we simply tried to erase from what we have available to us all these things that were maybe produced under what would be, by today's standards, immoral conditions, we would have very little cultural history available to us, right?
Absolutely.
You know, we would be living in a bubble of just things made over the last couple of decades, probably, depending on how far you took that argument. So, yeah, I think there is a sort of ethical imperative to keep these sorts of films and these sorts of materials around to provide a sense of historical perspective, even if at the same time they may be troubling by today's standards.
You include a beautiful quote from Dave Thompson when he writes, quote, "The girls who made cheap stack films in the 1920s were no less actresses than those who perform in the big budget movies of today, and no less deserving of the viewer's admiration and respect. In fact, they may have even merited more, for today's stars are essentially rumpling sheets that have been rolled on for close to a century. The actresses of the 1910s and 20s were looking at a freshly made bed." This is a great quote to talk about what pioneers these women were. Can you tell us more about the experience of the women making these movies that you found in your research, and what can we take away from their performances today?
Well, certainly, as folks like Linda Williams have demonstrated, a lot of these women were actually professional sex workers. And this was an easy way for somebody to come in with a 35mm camera or 16mm camera later on and make some continuing money off of those folks for a one-time, you know, labor that they were doing. In other cases, though, sometimes there were amateurs, you know, amateur porn being made and then has later become available. So, for example, one person that I quote is Hester Nash, who's the founder of Retro Raunch, which is one of the first, I believe maybe the first, major vintage porn website. And she says that a number of the donations that she's received from people over the years of stag films and whatnot were from, you know, widowers who basically said, well, you know, here was my wife or my girlfriend or whoever from decades and decades before. I love them very much. And so here's this stuff as a way of almost kind of keeping that love alive indefinitely by digitizing it and making it available to a new generation of people.
Edison created the phonograph to record the voice of people before they die. It's connected to death, recording people so they can live in the afterlife.
And I think it's fascinating that then those same sorts of materials would gain a continuing archival or digital afterlife and perhaps still inspire some of the same sorts of activities that they did even back in the 20s or 30s.
Could you kind of, for people that want to look more at this, so could you give us like a little bit of a tour of the online scene that is some of the better resources to see these vintage pornography, but also, you know, talk about a little bit in your book with how you theorize what they're doing with this vintage stuff as well?
There are certainly a number of websites, quite a few, devoted to vintage pornography or vintage erotica of different kinds. Some of these are more sort of fan-generated websites like Vintage Erotica Forums, which has a lot of stuff digitized just by amateur folks and made for non-commercial purposes. And then there are lots and lots of online pay sites, Retro Raunch that I just mentioned, and a bunch of others continuing on since then. Some of the more interesting types of providers, though, I think are folks like Vinegar Syndrome, the DVD company that also has an online streaming site called exploitation.tv. And one of the things that they do is, you know, they've put a lot of restoration work into a wide range of different films, largely from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But those are ways to see these films in ways where they look much cleaner and much less censored than they might have been for many, many years. I always recommend them as a key place to track down some of these films. Certainly there are all sorts of other companies. Something Weird Video has been pioneers in terms of putting a lot of these films out. DistroPix, who I mentioned earlier. There are quite a few companies that are trying to do more sort of respectful treatments of these films and not just simply sell them as, you know, goofy historical oddities, basically.
Well, that seems like at least a good place to start. Thank you so much. This has been tremendous. I think we've learned a lot here about the vintage scene. It's really remarkable. Really remarkable book, so please do pick it up if you can. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
I want to thank David so much for being so amenable to being my second attempt at doing a podcast interview. There's so much more great stuff in the book that we didn't get a chance to talk about, so please do check out the book when you get a chance. I think you'll really enjoy it, and there's some really unique takes on porn history. There's a link to some of the retro porn websites that we talked about during the interview in the show notes. And while you're looking at some vintage photos on the web, please do follow us on our social media channels. You can follow us on Facebook at Academic Sex and on Twitter at Porno Cultures. Thanks so much for listening, and I look forward to getting sexy with you next time. Bye.